Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe, on behalf of the United Coalition for Advanced Nuclear Power. In this podcast, we're talking to leaders from industry, government, and academia about securing America's energy future by bringing new nuclear technologies to the civil power market and for bolstering our national security. When people talk about advanced nuclear, they often use the word innovation. In this episode, we'll be discussing a company that epitomizes the very best in creative, outside-the-box thinking. So if nuclear innovation is your thing, you've come to the right podcast. Our guest today is the co-founder of Deep Fission, an advanced nuclear company with a very unique concept for reactor deployment. Liz Muller is Deep Fission's chief executive officer and previously co-founded and led Deep Isolation, a pioneering nuclear waste disposal company, and today she serves as Deep Isolation's board chair. She's multi-talented. Aside from being a serial entrepreneur, she has her name on multiple patents, has been recognized as a rising star in the nuclear industry, and is a published author, a dance instructor, and a mother of two, among many other things. One thing we value at UCAN Power is transparency, and Deep Fission does a great job in this regard. Please check out their website, deepfission.com, where there's a wealth of information about the company, including the 30-page white paper Deep Fission submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission explaining their reactor and deployment concepts. It's all out there for the world to see, and trust me, you'll be impressed. So Liz, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Jim. I'm really happy to be here.
All right, so everyone's got a backstory. What's your background? How did you get into the nuclear industry?
Yeah, great question. I grew up in Berkeley, California. So Berkeley, California is not known for a particularly pro-nuclear stance. In fact, I remember when I was a kid and Berkeley became a nuclear-free zone, and all of the kids were cheering, the teachers were cheering, they were telling us what a momentous occasion this was and how proud they were that Berkeley was now nuclear-free. Now, of course, I had a professor of nuclear physics as a father, and so when I came home and I said, Daddy, guess what? Berkeley's now a nuclear-free zone. This is wonderful. He sort of jumped all over it. Well, that's ridiculous. There's no such thing as a nuclear-free zone. You're radioactive. I'm radioactive. Everyone at your school is radioactive. And I think my take home from that moment was, wow, nuclear is really complicated and it's really controversial. And I don't think I knew anything more than that, other than it was a scary subject that people have very strong feelings about on both sides. But in my 20s, I moved to France. And in France, nuclear is not controversial or wasn't controversial. It was just normal. And every time I would ask somebody about, you know, do they support nuclear power, I would get this, well, of course I support nuclear power. It's clean. It's always on. It's reliable. It's you know, good in every single way. And around that time, global warming was also becoming more of a concern around the world and for me personally. And when I moved back to the US, I was frustrated with a lack of attention to global warming, particularly a lack of really doing things that were going to move the needle. So we're doing a lot of little things that may not actually have much of an impact, but we aren't doing a lot of big things that could actually have an impact. And so that brought me back to nuclear power as, you know, a big thing. If we could really lean into nuclear power, then that would have an impact on global warming.
So you founded Deep Isolation several years ago. You know, your goal there is to put the spent nuclear fuel way far underground. Talk us through how your work with Deep Isolation led you to the concepts that underpin Deep Fission.
Yeah. So, you know, again, moving back to the US, the real two reasons that people would give, I mean, there's sort of people talk about accidents as well, but the safety profile of nuclear is really outstanding. So I'm not going to include that. But the two reasons that people would give for not doing more with nuclear power was cost. It's too expensive. It's too expensive in the US. And the second one is the unsolved nuclear waste problem. So I thought a lot about both of those. Wasn't clear I had much I can contribute on cost. But on the unsolved nuclear waste problem, it was an industry that has not seen a lot of innovation, particularly around nuclear waste disposal. So we're still talking about the concept that came out of the 1960s and 70s and 80s, this concept of a mind repository. And there hasn't been a lot of new ideas that have come around since then. At the same time, in the oil and gas industry, we have gotten really, really, really good at drilling very deep holes. And one of the remarkable things about nuclear waste is how compact it is. And so you don't need humans underground. You don't need big tunnels with air and ventilation systems. If you just use directional drilling, you can put the waste deep, deep underground, much safer, cheaper, easier to implement, more flexible in terms of where it can go. So that was what led to Deep Isolation. Now, Deep Isolation is now about 9 years old as a company and is doing well. And one of the customers that we had asked us to look at a number of different accident scenarios. And one of the accident scenarios was, what if accidentally you put fresh fuel? So you don't dispose of nuclear waste, you put fresh fuel underground. What is the risk of criticality? And we did the calculations, and there was no risk of criticality for a single fresh fuel assembly. But it was an interesting question, because going back to the cost issue, the reason that nuclear power is so expensive is the construction, and it's the physical concrete, cement, steel, reinforcement, and all of the quality assurance that needs to go with all of that. In order to create 160 atmospheres of pressure for the nuclear reactor to create high quality steam, and then also to contain everything in case anything goes wrong. So those two things are the reason that the estimated 80% of the cost of nuclear is in that construction. And when you're in a borehole a mile underground, you actually have not just the containment, which we knew about because of that's why you dispose of nuclear waste underground, but you also have 160 atmospheres of pressure just by virtue of the column of water that's above you in the borehole. And so it was a aha moment in which we realized that we actually have the conditions in a borehole to potentially take 80% of the cost out of nuclear power.
Okay, so in a nutshell, you're taking a small pressurized water reactor and you're putting a mile underground. Because we're audio only, we just want to kind of paint a picture for our listeners what this actually physically would look like. A couple of things, how wide is this borehole? How are the reactor components arranged? How big is the reactor? I'm sure it's narrow and tall. And then where's the balance of plant equipment located? Could you kind of just talk us through that and paint that picture?
Yeah, so we're looking at having, so our design is for existing standard pressurized water reactor fuel assemblies. So one wouldn't go critical. That was what we tested for Deep Isolation. So we came up with a design in which we have four of them packaged together into a thin-walled, I'm calling it a reactor container. So there, the pressure inside and out is the same. And so you don't need these big thick walls that you traditionally would have for a reactor vessel. So four fuel assemblies in a slim container that you lower a mile underground. So you're still attached to a cable that you could, that comes all the way to the surface. That generates heat. So it is surrounded by water. It is in a closed loop system, and the heat that it generates then heats a secondary loop, which flashes to steam, and then the steam shoots to the surface. So we're able to use systems that are already exist for geothermal in terms of how do you get that steam to the surface, and then the turbine and the cooling systems are on the surface.
And how wide is that borehole?
So it's a 30-inch borehole, at least for our initial design, which really is the sweet spot between what we can do with existing technology, so existing off-the-shelf drilling technology that we're very familiar with. We would love to go to larger holes. So if we start talking about a 45-inch hole, then we can get even better fuel efficiency, fuel economy, better output. But we're just going to start with a 30-inch hole for now.
Okay, great. And so basically, most of the balance of plant equipment is on the surface. The steam
yes.
comes up and you do the conversion up there. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah,
and
right.
about the boreholes themselves, what is the state of technology in drilling these? I mean, there's got to be some massive machinery that drills a mile deep, 30-inch wide borehole. What's the state of the technology there?
Yeah, so the good thing is the technology exists. It's not your standard oil and gas equipment. So most oil and gas boreholes, they can go potentially a lot deeper, but they tend to be quite narrow. So 4 to 8 inches is common at depth. 30 inches is a big borehole. So we're looking at getting a very large rig, possibly the sort of rig that you would use, typically use for deep ocean oil and gas developments. But you can do it, and you can drill the hole. There are people who have drilled large holes, so it has happened before. And that's where we would start. So there's existing off-the-shelf equipment. We have spoken to multiple drillers who've been able to give us quotes on exactly how they would do this, what equipment they would use. We're not going to be the drilling experts ourselves. We're really going to work with existing drilling companies who are familiar with and have done holes like this in the past.
So a typical reactor would be doing all sort of site characterization and environmental studies. I'm sure you'll have to do that on the surface, but since your reactor is going a mile underground, it's really more about what's happening down there. I mean, is this expensive to drill the hole, or is this something that compared to what you have to pay for a land a normal land-based reactor, is it much better cost efficiency for you?
Yeah, it's much better cost efficiency. So, it's not that hard to get a quote on drilling a hole. And so I'll give a ballpark estimate, which is about $6 million for a single hole to these specifications. So it's not really cheap, but nor is it comparable with the sort of hundreds of millions to billions of dollars that is typically expected for pressurized water reactors above ground.
Right, and just for clarity, that the hole itself, it's got a sleeve in it so that
Yes.
all the equipment and the reactor, they're not touching the rock directly. Is it metal or
Yeah,
aluminum
casing. So it's
or
typically steel casing,
steel casing? Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about manufacturing. Are you going to be building the reactors themselves in a factory somewhere, a centralized location? Will you fuel them in the factory? And do you think that Deep Fission will be doing that themselves, or are you going to bring in an industry partner? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a lot of thoughts, a lot of not a lot of answers just yet. I think one of the big questions that we're going to want to get an answer to early on is the level of nuclear quality assurance that we're going to be required to do. Part of this is because if you're in a reactor a mile underground, it's hard to come up with an accident scenario that would impact the humans or the environment. And so, if that's true, then we may not need a high degree of nuclear quality assurance. We may not need any degree of nuclear quality assurance. And that will certainly impact our supply chain and our manufacturing process. So, just based on transport of fuel, we do expect it'll be probably easier to put the fuel into the reactor container on site. Rather than transporting it all together. But that is still to be determined.
Yeah, and you brought up maybe my second favorite topic, which is fuel. What is your fuel form? You said it's just standard, assemblies, so it's under 5% enriched, basically, uranium oxide fuel. Okay.
Yeah, so we're looking at 5% enriched, as close to what the supply chain is used to delivering as we can possibly get it.
So you're avoiding the HALEU conundrum, where a lot of these, really terrific companies are bringing forward some really great designs, but they don't have the fuel supply chain quite yet lined up. But you're saying you can tap into existing supply chains right now, basically.
That's right. Yes.
Okay, so our listeners will want to know, what are the basic operational characteristics that you see from the reactor itself? What's the lifespan, and what sort of output are you talking about for each reactor?
We're looking at 15 megawatts electric per hole, but the fuel will only last about 2 years, so fairly tight fuel cycle. We are looking at the option of then at the end of the fuel cycle, lowering the fuel deeper into the hole so we can actually drill the hole slightly deeper than a mile. And then you lower the next reactor on top of the previous one. And this could actually keep going for the lifetime of the casing. So that's what we think our limiting factor is, which we think is probably going to be 50 to 60 years. So maybe 30 refuelings over that lifetime.
That's a very interesting concept, is you just don't have to worry about storage or disposal anytime in the near future, at least. Okay. And you talked about also a single hole, a single borehole. Are you planning to do multiple boreholes at the same site, and how much of a footprint does that need? And I got to ask you about the accuracy. I mean, if you're going down a mile and you're off by, 1%, you could be, a couple of hundred feet in one direction or the other. But it sounds like the technology is such that the accuracy is very high for these boreholes going straight down.
Yeah, so let me start with the implementation. So we do expect our first customer is Endeavor Data Centers, and they have committed to 2 gigawatts of electricity that they need to start. So we may end up doing more than that with them. So they have a big need, and so they're not looking at just one of these reactors. We're looking at hundreds of them. We expect the first module to maybe be 5 reactors. So we're still figuring this out specifically, and we'll need to get agreement with the regulator on this. But we're looking at a standard module of about 5 reactors, about 75 megawatts electric, that can then be implemented module by module as you go. So that's what we're working towards right now. In terms of the accuracy of the drilling, the oil and gas industry is really good at monitoring and measuring things downhole. There are also techniques that you can use, such as starting with a slim hole. So the narrower your hole, the easier it is to be very precise about location. So you can also start with a slim hole and then widen it out, or you can drill the hole, but then as you know, you're not quite as precise as you would be. We are expecting about a 5 to 10 meter spacing between holes.
That's really close. That's
Pretty
incredible.
close.
Those sort of tolerances are really, really impressive. One of the aspects that you've talked about in other fora and also on your website is how quickly you can deploy a borehole. It's not
Yeah.
a multi-year process. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because if you can bring these to the market a lot quicker than others, that's a terrific thing to be able to say.
Yeah, so we have solid quotes that we're looking at 3 to 4 weeks per hole for the drilling. So this is not, we're not even talking months here. We're talking about weeks. Now, yes, if you have a bunch of holes, well, then that can build up. But that's probably compared to construction, it's just dramatically simpler, it's dramatically faster. Now, you'll also need to insert the reactors, lower them down the holes. So we are looking at about 6 months total from the time that we get the permission to build to the time that we can have an operating reactor.
Well, that's a lot faster than what we're hearing from most other companies by almost an order of magnitude. So that is great to hear. But there's also safety advantages, and you've talked about them elsewhere as well, where by being down so far underneath ground, there are just some natural characteristics you're taking advantage of. Can you just kind of walk us through the safety case for putting a small pressurized water reactor that far underground?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this has been studied for nuclear waste disposal. So we understand that things really don't move through rock really at all. I mean, you're talking about 1.5 million years in order for something to potentially move forward through the rock, and then the amount that's going to get out is very, very low. So your real concern is just around the borehole itself. So can anything come up through the borehole? Can it get out through the casing? Could it potentially get out into the water table? And the good news there is that the oil and gas industry also has best practice that could be applied. Now, in the oil and gas industry, they constantly have nasty stuff coming up through the borehole. So if a borehole is operating for 20 years or 30 years, it's a constant concern. You have to be very careful that the casing doesn't degrade, that nothing can get into the water hole, the water table. Now, in our reactor, in contrast, there's nothing dangerous that's going to be coming up through the borehole. It's just going to be steam that's coming up. So it's really only the accident scenario in which you need to be concerned about possible contamination, and that can be mitigated. The chances of it even getting up to the top of the borehole is pretty low, and it's not going to happen fast. And so you have time to shut down the reactor, you have time to close off the reactor, you can seal it off, you can make sure that nothing's going to get to the surface. And so this is really a huge advantage in which it's hard to imagine a scenario in which anything could come to the surface. And if there is a risk, then you can take actions that will mitigate that even further.
Yeah, I was thinking that the biggest probably pushback you're going to get on this are the folks that are just really worried about environmental impacts, and rightfully so. We should all worry about that and be very attuned to that. But you're drilling down a mile into rock, and you've got a sleeved borehole, and you've got, a mile of water above it as a pressure column. That's pretty incredible right there. So it sounds like you've thought this through pretty well on the environmental side. I mean, I guess what you're saying is if they can be pumping, oil products up through a borehole and not have a problem with the water table, and all you've got is a pipe with steam in it. It's okay. So, where can we deploy these? I mean, are there only certain parts of the country where this would work, or is it pretty much anywhere except a few small locations? What is your sense of that?
So in terms of geology, it's very flexible. So you're not really using the properties of rock. You're using the properties of rock to hold the casing of the borehole. So it's quite flexible. And so we're really looking at being limited by political, commercial, those sorts of factors more than by geologic factors. So, of course, as you know, there's a number of states in the United States that you cannot currently deploy nuclear power. We would also want to be near our customers. So finding those locations is actually a big priority of ours right now.
Okay, and what's your disposition? You already talked about the potential for lowering the reactor once the fuel was spent and just kind of lowering it down a little bit further and putting another one on top of that. Is there any thought of, bringing the reactor back to the surface and disposing of it in the more traditional way, or where are you in that?
Yeah, so you can, right? So that's something that, again, the oil and gas industry is very good at pulling things back up again. They do it every day. So we could pull it back up, but we think it's probably in the best interests of everyone not to. So when you pull it back up again, there is potential risk, particularly if you're pulling up the reactor container, the spent fuel. There's contamination risk. We just want to avoid that. So we could do that if we are required to, and we are convinced that by leveraging existing safety standards and deep isolations work on emplacing and potentially retrieving spent fuel, we can do whatever we need to do if it's required. But we think that a more attractive option is to leave it there. Now, we can leave it there for storage. We expect that that is a reasonable option. But of course, in the United States, we cannot call it disposal. So we would need for the Nuclear Waste Policy Act to be amended in order to leave it there as a disposal option.
A mile deep, which sounds like
A
a pretty
mile
good
deep.
disposal option to me. So you've talked about you've got a data center company that you're collaborating with. It sounds like this technology translates to just about anyone who needs power. I mean, are there other specific industries you're looking to collaborate with, or is it just mostly data centers at this point?
We're starting with data centers because it is there's an urgent need for it right now and a readiness and a willingness to move forward quickly. So that is where we're starting. I think eventually, yes, this could be a utility option. It could be an option for powering homes and industry and businesses and everything else. But it makes sense as a business to start with one particular use case scenario, and the data centers one is the one that has the most urgency to it.
And there's a lot of talk also about using nuclear to power vital military installations in the US to give them that resilient power. How does this fit into that paradigm? Is this something that the Department of Defense should be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, there's always advantages and disadvantages for various different systems. One of the advantages of being in a borehole a mile underground is it's hard to imagine an accident scenario in which there's any sort of, plane crashes into it, it gets bombed. It doesn't really matter. It's not going to impact the nuclear reactor, though it could impact the turbines and the cooling systems. So that's a huge advantage. Now, one of the disadvantages is it's not mobile. Right, so this is never going to be something where you can pick it up and then remove it and then put it somewhere else, 50 miles away. So that's there are definitely some use cases, particularly around bases, where I think this could be a very attractive option, but it's not going to be a mobile system.
I'll just share that in the data center world, there's a lot of opposition growing about the fact that the data centers are taking all the electricity off the grid. And there's also concerns about, okay, if you co-locate a nuclear plant with a data center, you've already got opposition against the data center, and now there's going to be some anti-nuclear people, and just maybe the physical, aspect of seeing a reactor right behind the data center kind of like doubles down on the people who are going to come out against it. But, putting that technology a mile underground where it's really out of sight, out of mind in a way, it sounds to me like that would be attractive to people who might otherwise be opposed to nuclear. I don't know what your experience is dealing with some of the kind of detractors from nuclear, but it sounds like it might mitigate some of their concerns.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, nuclear power is so safe already. The current existing fleet of nuclear power is so safe that I hate to say that we're safer, because it's already very, very safe. But there is a certain subset of the population that doesn't have maybe a intellectual response to the safety. They have more of a emotional response when thinking about nuclear power, and their concerns around safety can be mitigated when they know that it's a mile deep under billions of tons of rock. So we've definitely seen that there is a subgroup of the population who feels better about nuclear power when it's a mile underground.
So you've got a technology and a deployment concept that is potentially much cheaper and much quicker to deploy than your traditional name a reactor, whether it's a small light water reactor, a large SMR, an AP1000, a Generation 4 reactor, whatever. But it all comes down to money. So I know you probably can't talk too much about this because a lot of this stuff is behind closed doors. But how's it going? How are the financial markets kind of reacting to your concept here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been really exciting. So one of the good things about our design is that because we're using existing oil and gas technology, we're using standard pressurized water reactor fuel and supply chain, it's not that hard for someone to come up with their own independent estimate of what our reactor is going to cost. So we have our own costs estimates, and we're putting those through the ringer, and we're sharing them with investors and customers, right? So we're being as transparent as we possibly can, because if there are any mistakes in our calculations, we want to know. Now, the number that we've shared publicly is we're looking at 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour for the first of a kind. So there's definitely room to have efficiencies later on. I mentioned earlier going to larger boreholes. There's definitely ways to bring that down. But for the first of a kind implementation, that's where we need to start, because you want to be profitable on the first of a kind. And if you're going to lose money, then people need to know, well, okay, how much money I'm going to lose? How many of these am I going to have to build until I can get to the nth of a kind reactor? And I think that's one of the reasons that people are reluctant to move forward with nuclear power, is because so frequently the first of a kind is not something that can be done profitably. So that's something that I think has been very well received. I think we are getting a lot of interest on the investment side, but also on the customer side, and even on the project financing side, where financing a new nuclear project has historically been extremely difficult. There's still, of course, the never having done it before risk, and so there is some technology risk there and some licensing risk. But when at least the cost suggests that the return is going to be very good, then that makes it easier to make those investments.
Well, thank you. This has been really a captivating tour de force of a really unique concept that's, you know, a lot of people are really buzzing. There's a lot of buzz about this right now. So thanks for taking the risk as a good capitalist and getting out there and putting yourself on the line. It's really great to see. But is there, what's the one thing you'd want listeners to this podcast to take away from this conversation?
I would say, I mean, I think there's so much optimism in the nuclear world right now, and we just need to do it, right? So I think we just need to move forward. We just need time. Unfortunately, we can't do this tomorrow, or maybe fortunately, right? There's a certain number of steps that need to be taken. So we're looking at commercialization in 2029. We're pretty excited about it, but we're always happy to hear directly from potential customers, from users, from anyone who's interested in the technology. They can learn more at deepvision.com, and we would really welcome any input that anyone has.
Well, great closing words. I guess that'll do it for this episode of the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. Thank you very much, Liz, for making the time to be with us and for a very intriguing conversation. It's clear that you're pursuing a highly innovative course of action. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and all the best to you and the team at Deep Vision for success in the years ahead. Again, for our listeners, please be sure to check out the company at deepvision.com. And thanks to our producer, the Houdini of podcast, Ms. Kimberly, and to all the team at UCAN Power for their support. Please check us out on social media and at ucanpower.org. Until next time, this is your host signing off with thanks to you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.